HFD has just released internal audio communication tapes that document how firefighters approached the fire and the challenges they faced. That fire raged for more than 4 hours, and at one point, as HFD was trying to get replacement oxygen tanks to their firefighters, the truck with the supplies breaks down on the side of the highway. Logistically, that's the last thing you need to happen while trying to get the fire under control. Let's listen to a string of clips illustrating other conditions HFD was dealing with that day.
Do you have a report on the fire conditions on the 27th floor?
Yes.
Heavy flames and smoke shooting out of the Malco balcony.
Engine 7 copy, thank you. Command from Engine 7, we have one conscious female patient. We need to bring her out of the building. We're using a central stairway at this time. Elevator controls. Is the elevator operating at this time?
Cap, this is lobby control. Elevator is not operating. That's negative. No elevator service available.
HFD Captain Scott Segarant joins us live in the studio for a look at some of the behind-the-scenes drama that unfolded. So, Captain, what are some of the other challenges that you folks faced that day?
Well, there was a lot of different challenges that we faced that day. First and foremost was late notification of the fire. So when you're at the fire station and somebody knocks on the door and then calls you out of the station to show you from the corner of the street that there's a fire raging and there's flames shooting out of the windows, that's really late notification.
Right. And usually people see it, they call 911, but in this particular case, our fire station, which was just like a couple blocks away, that's how they heard about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So normally with a alarm system that's functioning properly, everyone is notified early. Occupants are notified early so they can get out, and the fire department is notified so that they can respond effectively.
Right. So I think over the last 6 months, maybe that fact about the notification was kind of lost in all the details that were unfolding week after week. I know your chief had said earlier this week that he thought that you could have lost some firefighters that day. Let's play another clip illustrating what happens when firefighters on a high floor get separated and the fear is that they're in danger. We're going to be listening to a Mayday distress call.
Mayday, Mayday, Mayday from Staging Alpha. We got firefighters in the...
And for a while there, the transmission goes silent, and you can only imagine what was playing out there. A short time later, we hear this.
Edit 7 Echo, did you declare an emergency? Is there any company declaring an emergency on B2 Attack 3?
Fire dispatch from Ladder 7, Staging Eva. We declared an emergency, but we retrieved all personnel from the 27th floor.
So what was going on there at that time? You know, what can you share with us?
Well, at that time, it's very difficult. You have flames, you have smoke, you have limited visibility. There's a lot of heat. And if you can't account for your personnel, that's one of the things that we are trained to do, is to declare a mayday.
And tell us, in that specific instance, do you know what was going on? You know, where were the firefighters?
That specific instance, I'm not sure. But it is a gut-wrenching situation when you're in there, especially as a captain or as a firefighter, knowing that something is wrong and you can't account for your personnel. That's very bad, very bad.
And tell us, what are the other criteria for declaring a mayday? Who can do that? What you know, to all of us listening here, explain that. It's a call for help.
Absolutely. Anyone can declare a mayday based on a need. So it could be an individual who finds himself trapped, disoriented, or maybe something fell on them. Any type of situation that they need help, they're declaring to everyone and saying, hey, I need help. But it could also be a captain, or it could be somebody else reporting on something that happened to a crew. It just depends on the specifics at that time.
What other stories can you share with us where that actually happened, where someone got separated?
So we had a separation and another mayday that was declared in the evacuation group. So these folks were assigned to evacuate occupants from the building, and they were escorting patients down to the 24th floor, and they would go back up and look for more and bring them back down. And as they were coming down, luckily without a patient at that time, there was a big blast of fire that came through the hallway into the stairwell and actually cut off that crew. So it separated the crew. And that fire blast is kind of what's referred to as like a blowtorch effect from the wind pushing the fire from the unit into the hallway, into the stairwell. And just imagine now that crew gets separated. And the crew that's above them has no idea what happened to the firefighter that went below. So that's very traumatic in a sense of you're concerned about your personnel. I mean, you eat with them, you live with them, one-third out of the year. And now you have no idea what's happened to that person.
Right, and you folks work 24-hour shifts, right?
Yep, 24-hour shifts. Basically, again, a third of the year. You're with them. That's your family for one-third of your career.
And when you're in a situation where it's a life or death event, you know, you're charged with trying to control the fire and protecting lives. And then you might be in a situation where one of your colleagues, your coworkers, is in jeopardy.
Absolutely. So that's worst case scenario. We try to train for that. We do train for that. But nobody knows how they react to that until it actually happens to them.
Right. And not too long ago, we had another high-rise fire, the first interstate fire. And in that case, that happened during a weekend. It was an office building, not a residential tower like Marco Polo is. And since then, since the Marco Polo fire, we've seen other fatal fires on the mainland where many lives were lost. And in some instances, the fire broke out in the evening. And so I know folks are wondering, you know, we did have four lives lost in Marco Polo, but the situation could have been different. It could have been much higher.
Absolutely. And it really, as bad as losing what we lost there was, it could have been a lot worse. And that's one of the things that when you're analyzing your own actions and your performance, you realize that despite those losses, which are significant and are not to be taken lightly, it could have been a lot worse. If it wasn't for the efforts of the firefighters that were there, putting their lives in harm's way to save others, it would have been way worse.
If I recall the interstate fire, I think there were a couple firefighters that might have been injured. You know, there's fumes you're dealing with. And in that case, they had to walk up, I don't know how many flights of stairs, just to begin fighting the fire. And that's with all the equipment that you've got on your back.
Absolutely. It's a lot of equipment. It's heavy. I mean, you do train for it. But to go through that experience and get to the top of that 24th floor, and you're tired, and then now you got to get an assignment and go do it. That's tough. So you're trying to get up there as fast as you can, but you can't get up there and then you need to take a 2-minute break to catch your breath. So you're pacing yourself and you're trying to move as fast as you can to be able to be functional once you get up there.
Right, and then firefighters that find themselves in a dangerous situation, where you're faced with, do I put out a Mayday call? You know, explain to us what that means. You know, like, do you have a special units that set aside to deal with Mayday calls? Because, you know, you're in the midst of fighting a fire.
Absolutely. And we do have an assigned group that is a rapid intervention team. But it depends on resources at that time. When you're looking at trying to evacuate people out of floors that are right above the fire, you have to prioritize. And that's the decision of the incident commander and the team to make. And if you're going to send people to evacuate patients, you might not have a writ in place. So you have to make those choices at that time. But we do normally have a writ team in place. And as resources get there, you're trying to effect that. So that's the question you need to ask. Am I going to put my RIT team in place in case something goes wrong for my firefighters? Or am I going to send that first unit up to try to evacuate people that are immediately in danger?
When you say RIT team, what does that mean?
Rapid Intervention Team. That's the group that's assigned to be the help when the Mayday is called.
Okay, and did we have that in place, or were we just overwhelmed?
We did have it in place. I don't exactly know at what portion we had that in place. I know our rescue team is primarily assigned that task because they're the absolute professionals in that. Our whole department is trained to that level, and in fact, that was the training that I was at in that morning into the afternoon, attending our RIT training. So it's provided and it's out there. But again, when you have a fire that's so overwhelming, it's so resource needed, you have so many occupants that can't get out on their own, you have a fire that's lapping up, that's fully developed, and you're trying to get ahead of it, it's difficult.
You shared with me earlier that that training that you were in was kind of an intense thing in the morning, and you folks had worked through lunch and were about ready to knock off, and then the Marco Polo fire was called. And so you folks were already tapped and then had to go on scene.
Absolutely. But we weren't the only ones that had experienced that. Ideally, you know, you want to go to a big fire fresh and ready for anything. But we know as firefighters, anything can happen. If you exercise at the station and let's say you went for a run, right after that you could get a call. So we're aware of that. We hope for the best, but we plan for the worst.
And are there any other stories you can share just about the efforts that went on that day? I know when we were out there covering that story, the incident commander, there was a question about whether he needed to get relieved because no one imagined that this fire would burn for as long as it did. And I think they did bring in someone else to give him a break. And as he was trying to do that, he realized this is too big of a fire to just hand off to someone else. And I think they worked it together.
They did. And when you're in the scene and you're in the moment, you're doing the best that you can, you're trained, but it is mentally taxing also, trying to keep track of everything that's going on. But it's even harder to hand it off now. How do you relay every single detail that you don't even remember that you know? That's why I think he declined.
Right, because if I recall, numerous times he was asked, do you need a break? You know, do you need to get spelled?
Yeah. No, excellent. He did an excellent job, but people are helpful. You know, they're trying to be helpful. Do you need a break? Do you need something else? A lot of times guys are going to, they want to do the job. You know, you look at Tom Brady, for example. He's having a hard game. He doesn't get pulled out of the game. He continues on and keeps working and does his job. The coach doesn't come in and play for Tom Brady. So I think in the same situation, I think if he needed a break, if he was totally overwhelmed where he physically couldn't do it, maybe he would have asked for help. But there was help at the scene. Different facets of help came in. We did have help with our evacuation group. We had operations run certain things in staging and operations, logistics. So there was help, but he's the incident commander. He has that responsibility, and he decided to maintain command.
Right, and he was praised for his efforts. And we understand he's retired.
Yes, he is. Yeah, yes, he is. And it was planned. It wasn't result of this.
Okay, all right. Is there anything else you can share with us just about, you know, the camaraderie after going through a fire like that and then what happens going forward?
Well, that's why the fire service is so respected amongst themselves. Even firefighters from other places that come here, there's a level of respect because we know they're doing the same thing that we're doing where they're from. And everybody knows you're relying on that next person in order to get home. And that's the difference in a lot of jobs for what we do. And I remember the atmosphere up there. It was a little more quiet than normal. Sometimes you're at a fire and you haven't seen someone in a long time. You either came in with them or you were stationed with them before. And there's a little quick reunion. Hey, how are you doing? I haven't seen you in a while. How's your children? This and that. Wasn't that much there in this fire because everybody knew how serious it was.
Right, and you knew that everybody had your back.
We knew that we had each other's back, But we also knew that this was a big, serious fire. And the realization of something going wrong was there. It All was right. really there.
Well, Captain Segarant, thank you very much for sharing the story behind what went on that day and underscoring the risk that our first responders take every day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Barbara Pleadwell, partner with Hastings and Pleadwell, huge supporters of Hawaii Public Radio. I wouldn't say it's a condition of Hastings and Pleadwell, but it's certainly a strong recommendation for all of our clients to be supporters of Hawaii Public Radio, especially those that are concerned about the future of journalism. That's why we support this station, and that's why our clients support this station.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a closer look at the results of a student survey of sexual harassment and gender-based violence at UH. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking of a Hawaiian queen who broke through cultural taboos as a champion for the rights of Native Hawaiian women. Often considered King Kamehameha I's favorite wife, she was the kingdom's first kuhina nui, a role comparable to that of a Western prime minister. The queen regent in question was in a cave called Pu'ukawiki on Hana in Maui, and was married to Kamehameha I when she was 13. She worked alongside the king to unite the Hawaiian Islands and wielded considerable political and social influence. She's perhaps best known for her influence in overthrowing elements of the kapu system because she felt oppressed by it. When Captain George Vancouver arrived on the islands in 1793, she saw that the men openly broke taboos, having no reservations about eating meals with women, for example. So this queen took initiative to Ainoa, our free eat, sitting among men, and that kapu was forever changed. Today we're looking for her name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Some say the release of a University of Hawaii survey about sexual misconduct this week couldn't have been better timed. A Hollywood sex scandal and the Golden Globe's focus on the issue sets the stage, keeping the attention on hashtag MeToo and after MeToo social media campaigns. That survey was triggered after UH turned up on a list of colleges whose response to sexual harassment complaints was lacking. All this week, we've heard how the survey establishes a baseline to track incidents and attitudes. But it was the domestic violence responses that startled some, not just because they were higher than the national norm, but also because it was across the UH system. So what do we do about it? We sat down with Jennifer Rose, the head of the UH Office of Institutional Equity.
To his credit, President Lasner, this was a huge priority for him. I mean, he is a researcher himself, and he was really intent on getting baseline data that we needed. You may not know this, but domestic violence is not an area that college campuses had been paying that much attention to. There were some federal mandates that required nationally for universities to take down data on not just domestic violence, but how we actually intervene or what kinds of services that we provide. You know, to his credit, he wanted a comprehensive look. This is one of the first surveys that looked at sexual harassment, stalking, sexual violence, and domestic violence in a comprehensive manner, as well as looked at perceptions of risk, Awareness of resources, awareness of reporting function, so not just the prevalence, but the true climate. And President Lasner did want all of that. And then we were very fortunate that we had the support of the legislature to fund us. So we received funding, G funds, that opened up my office, which is the Office of Institutional Equity. It's a system-wide office that supports all the 10 campuses in their Title IX and Violence Against Women infrastructure for reporting. So then we had the resources to do it, and we wanted to make sure that we did it well. And we're pretty proud of this 216-page report.
And the domestic violence issue is something that kind of took everybody by surprise.
Well, if you asked Nancy Creedman, she would say she wasn't surprised. I wasn't surprised. I've been doing domestic violence work for 20-something years. But I agree with you that most people found that really surprising, that to have such a consistent rate across all 10 campuses, that wasn't true with the other forms of gender-based violence or sexual harassment, to be that consistent. And, you know, frankly, to be that high. So it is troubling, but, you know, we looked at behaviors both on and off campus. Well, many of these behaviors may be occurring off campus. It's our responsibility to ensure that students are supported and make sure that they get their education. So now we know more mental health resources. We have this great collaboration with Domestic Violence Action Center. I don't know if the community knows, we have their advocates positioned on a number of our campuses on Oahu. So students can go directly to them if they don't feel comfortable going to a university official.
I think people are saying, all right, great, we have a baseline, and what do we do about it? So is there a plan going forward? You mentioned that eyes are just now focusing on this study because it's just been officially released, and so there hasn't been time to really set up maybe a system and a game plan, like, okay, deadlines. You know, each campus comes up with their own ideas on how to address what's happening in their area. But what happens going forward?
Well, actually, we have set up exactly that. I think you articulated that so well. We've met with the chancellors at all of the campuses, and they are designating one person to take the lead with action planning. Most of them will designate their Title IX coordinators because they are responsible for climate on their campus, and they have already done so. And we're meeting with them in just a couple of weeks to start the action planning process. So they will choose one or two priorities. Many of the campuses may say the same thing. Domestic violence, this is you know, clearly a problem. We haven't prioritized this. Other campuses may look at some of the programming that they're already doing that's successful and find ways to build on it. So that's what I'm looking forward to. This is just the beginning. I've been waiting for this moment to actually have this dialogue. I'm really interested in what kinds of program development. The other interesting thing, too, Catherine, is that the majority of students, overwhelming number, said that they thought that the survey was extremely useful or helpful in improving policies. So we want to make sure that we make good on that promise to the students and look at how we can improve. And I'm not just talking about our specific sexual harassment policy, but broader. What's our policy development around mandatory training, for example? You know, what's our policy around the amount of training that students should receive at orientation? So those are the kinds of things that we're going to ask the chancellors to look at. They are expected to have their action planning process done by early summer.
Okay, and then what about funding? Because if we boost the access to mental health counseling or help that students might need, where's that going to come from?
Right. That's a great question. It's a fair question. I don't know exactly the answer to that. I know that you know, beyond the campus's capacity, the system, and my office has some capacity to do system-wide training, but otherwise we may be going to the legislature. We have done creative things. For example, our collaboration with the Domestic Violence Action Center is through VOCA money. It's through federal money, so the university is not paying for that. It's being paid by the federal government through a nonprofit that is providing the resources and the expertise. And we've also built collaborations with nonprofits that do domestic violence and sex assault work across all the neighbor islands. So we hope that somehow we can bolster our community partnerships, but not in a way that takes away from their resources. And hopefully we'll have to go back to the legislature.
Do you think this whole After Me Too campaign will help? Because it's on a national stage.
Yes, I think, you know, there are a lot of students that are interested in, and there are some that have already contacted me or our office. I've talked to some folks yesterday, in fact, who said they were just waiting to do something. And so I think a lot of you know, student activists want to be involved, engage in this process. I think the fact that there is a lens, you know, on sexual harassment, it's something that I always thought was important for us to address. And I don't want to take away anything from any of the other forms of violence. I think it's also important for us to take a close look at stalking and domestic violence. But I think that that momentum is going to help. And I think that people are already engaged and starting to have a better analysis. And I think we have to pay close attention to the power dynamic.
Correct. Because if power and control is at the core of this, yeah. The structure of academia, and we've seen other studies point to a number of cases or reports that deal with graduate students and tenured faculty.
Yes. And, you know, that's the case. It's not just in Hollywood, right? It's a case across the board. Anytime that there is that kind of power differential, there's always the opportunity for that abuse of power. And like I said earlier, they are our employees, and we have a responsibility to ensure that kind of advantage is not being taken. And, for example, we have a policy on consensual relationships. And looking at that power differential, maybe as a result of this dialogue, we have to look at strengthening it or changing it. That'll be a really interesting conversation to have. I'd like to hear from faculty members as well and what they think. And there are a lot of really great faculty allies in this. You know, some of them who wrote me already said, you know, these stats are kind of grim, but I'm really happy that you did this. You know, let's just be honest about what's happening and see how we can start addressing this through better programs and training.
Okay. And so let's see what comes forward in the summer. And hopefully we can have you back on
yes,
again.
Yes, that would be great.
And continue this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you. That was Jennifer Rose, the director of the University of Hawaii's Office of Institutional Equity.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Chaminade University, Inter Island Solar Supply, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
Many a lonely child has found solace in an imaginary friend, one that provides reassurance, guidance, and companionship. In the 1956 French short film The Red Balloon, that friend is a balloon that often seems to have a mind of its own and accompanies Pascal, a little boy, on a series of mostly wordless adventures through the streets of Paris. There are lessons to be learned along the way about the world of the imagination and the cruelties children can inflict on one another. The story has become a children's classic, and playwright Annie Cusick-Wood has adapted The Red Balloon for the Honolulu Theater for Youth with atmospheric Parisian music by Pierre Grill, and both Annie and Pierre are with us in our studio. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for coming in. Music is very much a part of telling this story, isn't it, Annie?
Yeah, it absolutely is, because as you said, it is a wordless film. I think we hear Balloon at one point in the film, and that's it. So
yeah.
When I was creating the show, we had I was looking for a musician, and I found Pierre Grill, who is French,
uh-huh.
and who his music had the exact correct style, kind of fun style, because the film is a beautiful, tender, poetic piece of work, you know, Oscar winning,
yeah.
and very much loved by many, many people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to find, you know, what I always say is, what can I bring to it? What can I bring to this stage adaptation that isn't in the film? So a wonderful new score is one, and one that highlights and charts the journey of Pascal. Another thing that we bring, of course, is a lot of humor, because it is a very, very sad film. So I've really delved into each character, and so did Pierre when we were creating the music. You know, we have a theme for each of the characters in the show. It was a really fun collaboration working with him and to create this great score.
Here's a sample of Pierre's music. It'll give you a pretty good idea. Well, I think most people, Pierre, would hear that and think Paris right away, right?
Yeah.
Why would they? The accordion, the waltz tempo.
That's it. You're stuck with all this stuff. The tubas and all the sweet clown music is there. All from Nino Rota, the Fellini movies, is what the whole sound is about.
Where it's almost the sound of the street becomes part of the music, right? You wouldn't want to hear it entirely in a sterile environment. You kind of want to hear...
No, it is street music.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting because a lot of the action happens out on the street as well in the film. You know, we have our setting is beautiful. It's a designer friend of mine from Scotland who designed it. And, you know, we have these two cubes that spin and whirl. So we're kind of in this, we don't have a scene change, but they move around and they open up and they become different landscapes. So we're always out in the street. And as you rightly said, like that piece particularly, that was the janitor's theme. If you watch the movie, you might go, well, who's the janitor? But there is a little clip of the janitor at the school with Pascal. So we've taken him and given him a relationship with the balloon as well, you know. So we have developed those characters with their music, but it is very true. It's very true to the film, you know, the play, I believe.
But in translating it to a theatrical environment, you're asking your very young audience to go in for some suspension of disbelief.
We
right?
are all playing a huge game of let's pretend, you know, and that's what I love about the theater, and that's what I love about this, working on this adaptation in particular, because, you know, we had no dialogue to start. So every word that we say on stage is there because we need to. There's not a lot of words. Quite a few are in French, which the children are loving right now, HTY. You know, they're repeating it, and they're saying, that means goodbye, you know, and they're, like, translating it. There's...
You know, one of the things that I've noticed in your shows before, Annie, is that you don't... you expect a fair amount of your very young audience, and they respond. That you don't talk down to them, you don't patronize them. If you want to present them with a difficult subject that they may or not be able to handle, you go ahead and do that, and they seem to be able to handle it. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Yeah, we really do. You know, we don't play it down. I mean, the film was, you know, it's hailed as a great film for children, but in fact, it was probably the first art film for children. It was real art. It was artful. It was beautifully shot, and it challenged the kids. You know, sometimes I think the kids at the end, you know, when the balloon gets popped at the end, some children go, "You can't do that. We're children," you know.
Yeah.
But
uh-huh.
actually, you know, this is a world that we live in where people will want to destroy your dreams. You know, but of course, you know, I do take them in that journey. Right down to that, you know, so they can feel for Pascal. And they really do, you know, like a couple of kids said to me, it made me sad or it made me cry. But of course, the redemption at the end, everybody leaves with spontaneous applause and cheering and so filled with happiness and joy. I don't play it down.
Well,
I expect them.
Before that redemption can come, there has to be a pretty troubling event.
Yeah, it really is. You can hear a pin drop in the theater when in that moment. I at one point I thought, if this is all I do in my career as a children's playwright, give these kids this moment of art and suspense and empathy and anticipation, then that's enough. It's gorgeous. So I really take them there.
You know, one of the things that taking back my own memories of childhood is so many things that attempt to reach out to children don't give them enough credit.
Yeah.
I remember feeling that a lot as a kid. Hey, I'm a little bit more able to process things than you, the adult, are giving me credit for.
Yeah,
right?
I think we do that well each time. And I have to say, Pierre's music as well is so rich and beautiful that they, you know, the children could sit in an audience in a theater for 50 minutes and just listen to the music, and that would be really phenomenal as well. So that really, you know, it charts the journey and the emotional journey beautifully, and they're with it. They're with it all the time. And it's the music at the end, the way that he has the finale that sends him into this, that along with the image that sends him into this huge applause at the end and moment of joy.
Pierre, let's play another sample of your music. Well, Pierre, it's one of the limitations of radio that our listeners can't see how you choreographed that. But what was the kind of visual image when you did that particular piece? What were you thinking about?
We had meeting with Annie and we created the music. Right? Trisa, it came to my mind the way she speaks, the way she mouthed the whole play. Mm-hmm. I recorded the whole thing. I got shut off. Okay, I'm back on the air. Anyway, she mouthed the whole play and she did all the dialogue. And the way she animates everything, boom, 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 the music just, the Madonna gives it to me, you know. Mm-hmm.
So you kind of, Annie, you kind of took Pierre through the story in real time.
Yeah, it was really fun. I went to the studio every week for a couple of months.
I had all the scenes, all 14 of them, all mapped out in time. Mm-hmm. No time match anything, but that's okay. It was a starting point, and then so I could, I need this. And then they finally don't talk, so I can make my music, you know. But I have to say something. Monday morning, I had the most incredible experience. Monday morning was the first show for the kids at school. And I was down there and I saw the show for the first time, finished and everything. I didn't have time to go to many rehearsals. I had movies. And then so here I was with all those kids and watching that show for the first time, finished. And I was high for 2 days after that. I could never land. It was incredible. And those kids, they didn't drop a knife for 50 minutes. They just went like, fascinated. It's when you see all the project for kids and blah, 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 it's not easy to do. The little lady, Annie there, she never drops a second of attention. They just stuck with it. And at the end, they just explode. And they laugh like nuts for the whole time. I mean, it's really a wonderful show.
Well, Annie and Pierre, you both make it sound like a wonderful show. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having us, Chris. Thank you.
Annie Cusick-Wood is the author and director of the Honolulu Theater for Youth production of The Red Balloon, adapted from the 1956 film by Albert Lamorisse. It opens tomorrow, runs Saturdays at 4:30 p.m. until January 27th at Tenney Theater on the grounds of the Cathedral of St. Andrew. It's suggested for ages 5 and up. Now it's time for us to dip into the mailbag and share your feedback. Following yesterday's oral health strategic plan discussion with Dr. Gavin Uchida, registered dental hygienist Rory Ullman wrote in saying,
she wrote, I wrote for some time on a committee years ago here in Hawaii in conjunction with Governor Wahei's health initiatives. I believe the segment with Mr. Uchida was a dumbed-down version of the problem, which has its roots not only in what the population consumes in their diets, but a complete and utter breakdown of the institutions which should be helping the population. This includes not only looking at what they put in their mouths, but the lack of real concern by the local dentists and a complete failure of the state institutions to provide preventative services that could help children by simply placing fluoride in the water they drink. I'm a dental hygienist. The full scope of our practice is prevention. I'm retired, but while practicing, I was an expanded function hygienist licensed in 3 states, including Hawaii and the Western region. With all due respect to Mr. Uchida, a hygienist should have his job. The private practice dentists watch the bottom line, not their patient's health. The state bows to kooks, dentists, and conspiracy theorists in regard to fluoride. Anyone opposed to fluoride in their water can drink bottled water and let our children receive the benefits of prevention via the tap. All they need to learn to do is open the tap, fill the glass, and drink the water.
And Dexter Rusty said this on Facebook. I don't think that fluoridation of our water is the answer. I grew up on well water and few cavities. I think definitely the intake of sugar and hygiene.
And Robert B. shared this on our Facebook page following last week's segment on the black market of diabetic strips. The cost of those test strips is criminal. What hurts patients is having to choose between the purchase of test scripts or making rent and food. Stacy Lynn Pihana, who was indicted for theft charges in that case, will make her first court appearance next week following her arrest Wednesday night. The former pharmacy worker is accused of stealing nearly $700,000 worth of diabetic test strips from the Waianae Coast Comprehensive Health Center, which ended up being sold on the black market.
We thank all of you for your feedback. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217.
The House this week voted to extend a program that allows the NSA to continue its controversial internet surveillance program. Representative Tulsi Gabbard voted against it, hoping for a compromise bill that would temper concerns over privacy rights and national security protections. She sets the stage for the Senate vote next week amid some confusing tweets from President Donald Trump.
The issue here is about a provision that was put into place, passed by Congress after the attacks on 9/11, that essentially allowed our intelligence agencies to collect information and communications on foreign targets with the intent of preventing terrorist attacks on America. So this is a program that and an intent that, as a veteran, I understand firsthand is critical to keeping the American people safe. However, there was a gaping loophole that our amendment yesterday sought to fix. And that loophole is that, let's say an American citizen is talking to a foreigner in a foreign country. Their communications may have been swept up in this collection done by the intelligence agencies. And the problem is that law enforcement agencies here in the United States were able to search and or use that information, the Americans' communications, without a warrant. And that was really the crux of what our amendment fixed, was saying, hey, look, we will maintain the ability for intelligence agencies to collect this information on foreign targets, but we're going to do so while also protecting the constitutional civil liberties of Americans by simply requiring a warrant for law enforcement agencies if they want to search or use that information that has been incidentally collected.
But where do we go from here since the House passed?
Unfortunately, our amendment, which is called the USA Rights Act Amendment, we got 183 Republicans and Democrats who voted for it, which was more than any other vote that we've taken in the past. Progress, but not enough. The underlying measure, which continues to reauthorize the Section 702, but without adequately fixing the constitutional issues with it, it passed the House and now will move on to the Senate. We've heard Republican Senator Rand Paul, Democrat Senator Ron Wyden, who've been kind of the two most outspoken people opposing this issue for the same reasons that we did in the House. So my hope is that they're able to try to address and fix these issues in the Senate before it is passed through.
So you're not giving up hope?
We can't give up hope. This is such an important issue, and I encourage people to call their senators and urge them to take action to fix this issue. Once again, this isn't a false choice between, are you going to take action to help maintain our national security or protect our constitutional rights. That's not the case. What our amendment did, which was bicameral, there's also a similar bill in the Senate, the USA Rights Act, it struck that necessary balance that upholds our constitutional rights while also making sure that our intelligence agencies, our national security agencies, have the tools they need to help keep the American people safe. There's a time factor on this, though, because the current authorization expires on January 19th. So the Senate is likely going to take action and try to send something to the president's desk before that date. So this is an urgent time. where we still have the opportunity to make these necessary reforms.
And we've heard the talk about the filibuster, and then there were also some confusing tweets from President Trump himself. So I guess we'll have to see what happens next week.
Well, we'll have to see what happens. The unfortunate thing about those tweets, and I looked at a lot of the coverage that was happening before the vote, actually while the vote was taking place and even afterwards, is rather than really sharing the information with the American people about what's at stake here, a lot of the news was really distracted and focused all their attention on these tweets, rather than saying, hey, look, here's a very real issue that's facing Congress and the American people. There are obviously different arguments that people are making, but there's a lot at stake. And so that's what I hope happens over the next week, is that the American people step up and encourage their senators, the people of Hawaii encourage our senators to take action on this and actually affect change. It's a nonpartisan issue, and that's what we found in the House. We had very liberal Democrats, very conservative Republicans, and a whole lot of people in between who came together and said, look, we're going to stand up for national security, and we're going to stand up for upholding and protecting the Constitution, something that every member of Congress swore and took an oath to do.
That was Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard talking about the upcoming Senate vote on what some call the NSA spying bill.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
Earlier in the show, we told you about a Hawaiian queen who broke from the tradition upheld by the kapu system by eating meals with men, taking lovers, and following Christianity. As the favorite wife of Kamehameha I, she pursued her modern for that time pursuits only after the king died in 1819. In the year after, this queen met Kamehameha II, wearing his father's robes, and said they would rule the kingdom together. In her ruling role, she was involved in disbanding the social class of priest. And soon after, when Christian missionaries came to the islands, this queen embraced them and their religion. She was baptized in December 1825 on the site where Kawaihao Church stands today and took the name Elizabeth. Her Christianity left a profound impact, and she released Hawaii's first codified body of laws deeply rooted in Christian morality and the Ten Commandments. Additionally, the Protestant missionaries she worshipped with persuaded her to sign legislation that forbade Catholic teachings and threatened to deport whoever broke the law. One of Queen Kaʻahumanu's final lasting impacts was negotiating the first treaty between the Kingdom of Hawaii and the United States.
And we have a winner in today's quiz, Brian Suzuki, whose nickname is Squirrel. He got it right. Congratulations, Brian. And that is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. The 2018 Hawaii Literacy Innovation Conference features Dr. Doug Fisher, January 29th through February 1st. Achieve3000.com/community/events.
There are always activities going on under the radar throughout the state, and that's where Morning Edition host Derek Malama can keep us up to date, looking at some of those under-the-radar events. Today, the Friends of the Library of Hawaii Music and Book Sale is coming up.
It's this weekend, but there is more. Now, the sale is at Washington Middle School tomorrow through Martin Luther King Day, but there's also this vinyl listening party in the Arts at Mark's Garage. That's tomorrow night from 5 to 8 p.m. Attendees are invited to bring a record that they purchased at the sale and play a track to showcase this musical gem that they discovered at the sale. DJs from Aloha Got Soul, KTUH, and HPR. will be, yeah, I didn't
go
know.
Figure.
This one surprised me. We'll be on hand to share their musical finds, and this event is free and open to the public tomorrow in the Arts of Mark's Garage.
And vinyl might actually tell you what the music is actually sounds like.
I know, vinyl.
Wouldn't that be nice?
I know, that warm sound.
Yeah. And you can talk story about Earth's largest active volcano tomorrow on Hawaii Island.
We're talking about Mauna Loa. You can view informational displays about the volcano at UH Hilo, UCB 127. Scientists and officials from the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, the Hawaii County Civil Defense, also University of Hawaii at Hilo, and the Hawaii Volcanoes National Park will be on hand to answer all of your questions. And this event is happening from noon until 3 p.m. at UH Hilo tomorrow.
And then in upcountry Maui, we've got a Japanese festival.
Yes, in Makawao, the Kekaulike Matsuri and Odori features great food, plus a kendo demonstration, taiko music, and Japanese dancing as well. This is happening from 5 until 8:30 p.m. tomorrow at Kekaulike High School cafeteria, and it's free.
Plenty to keep us busy through the weekend, Derek.
Oh, definitely, yes.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And that's it for this week on The Conversation. Coming up next week, we're preempted for Monday's Martin Luther King Day holiday, but join us on Tuesday for a panel discussion on advocating for civil engagement.
And on Wednesday, we'll be taking the show on the road, broadcasting live from the state capitol on opening day. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's a number at 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR.
Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn. Our intern is Emily Cardinale.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday and pick up The Conversation.